From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the declining health of the Earth's oceans. We talk with LA Times reporter Ken Weiss about how overfishing and the byproducts of human civilization have fundamentally altered the chemistry of the seas, producing dead zones and the sprawling growth of toxic algae. His five-part series, Altered Oceans, has won the prestigious George Polk Award. Also, actor Gabriel Byrne talks with us about acting, growing up in Ireland, and the strains of moving to Hollywood at age 40. His films include Miller's Crossing, The Usual Suspects, and the new movie, Gendabine. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Fountains of Wayne. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. If you've ever been troubled by beach pollution or a coastal oil spill, my guest, Los Angeles Times writer Kenneth Weiss, says what's happening in the deep oceans of the world will really scare you. In a five-part investigative series with co-writer Usha Lee McFarling, Weiss says humans have fundamentally altered the chemistry of the oceans, creating oxygen-deprived dead zones and spawning growths of toxic algae which spread at alarming rates. The series recently won the prestigious George Polk Award for Environmental Reporting. Weiss and McFarling are in New York for the Polk Awards, presented at a luncheon today. Well, Ken Weiss, welcome to Fresh Air. You begin this series by describing the appearance of some very troubling vegetation in the waters of Moreton Bay, Australia. Almost a science fiction-like story. Describe this weed.
It is a very strange and bizarre situation. Fishermen there have been plagued by boils and rashes that affect all parts of their body, including their private parts. And in fact, at first they didn't know what was going on, and they thought they were passing around a social disease. But over time, they figured out that it was actually connected to this black, hairy growth that they were pulling up in their nets. And no one believed them that it could possibly be so toxic until a bucket of the stuff made it back to the University of Queensland Marine Botany Laboratory. And there it got put in a seaweed dryer, and essentially the toxic fumes from the seaweed drove professors and lab techs and students streaming into the street, eyes tearing, choking, coughing. It's very caustic stuff.
So, and the fishermen get their boils from coming in contact with nets that have been in the water and that have touched this stuff?
Exactly. It turns out it's a cyanobacterium, and basically little bits and pieces of it are mixed in the water and come running down their arms, off their hands, down their arms into their clothing, and they get covered with this.
Now, this is a primordial substance, an algae, or what is it?
Yeah, this is really the primordial ooze. This is a type of cyanobacteria that used to rule the world 2.7 billion years ago. And that was a time when the oceans were a very caustic place. And these things have very good defense mechanisms and not afraid to use them. What's interesting now is that it's come back in Moreton Bay, and it's growing at an astonishing rate.
How fast can it grow?
It can basically grow about a football field an hour covering the seafloor. And so it starts off as little spores and then sprouts little tufts of black hairy weed, cover the seafloor, and then over time it creates its own oxygen, essentially, and lifts up to the surface and then is in big floating mats, sometimes the size of football fields, floating, and they end up washing ashore and driving out fish and causing general problem for fishermen.
Now, what's interesting about this series and the growth of primordial algae and microbia like this is that you're describing a kind of pollution that's different from what we typically think of, is where we dump a toxin into the water. This is actually dumping nutrients, too much food into the ocean, right?
Right. This is an issue of too much of a good thing. Nitrogen and phosphorus and iron and carbon dioxide, all things that plants and animals need for their lives. But we're stoking the oceans with sort of a daily infusion of Miracle-Gro. And there's a scientist who I think sort of sums up very succinctly what's going on here. This fellow named Jeremy Jackson at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, he says we fail to follow the basic homeowner's rule of thumb, that be careful what you dump in the swimming pool and make sure the filter is working. So if you think of the oceans as just a very big pool, we're using them as a communal toilet for sewage and runoff from farm lots and animal feedlots and a slurry of waste off city streets. And at the same time, we're stripping out all the coastal wetlands that used to take up these nutrients, and we've removed most of the oysters and clams and small fish that used to eat a lot of this algae. And the result are these prolific blooms of algae and bacteria, and many of them are toxic.
And you've seen this phenomenon all over the world, right?
It's popping up everywhere. It's quite remarkable. And so often these are reported in newspapers as local freakish phenomena. But the fact is that they are actually happening all over the world.
What is a dead zone?
A dead zone, it was a term used to describe a low oxygen area in the ocean. What happens is we have this all this nutrients washing into the ocean, creates a big bloom of algae, and as the algae dies, it sifts to the bottom. Bacteria start to break it down, and as the bacteria break down all this plant matter, it sucks all the oxygen out of the ocean. And the term dead zone is really a misnomer because there are lots of things that live in dead zones, mostly bacteria and jellyfish and a few worms. The biggest one in this country is off the coast of Louisiana, and it's been as big as the size of the state of New Jersey. Very often the dead zones have nothing in them except for this sort of white, snot-looking bacteria all over the bottom feeding on carcasses of dead crabs and anything that couldn't swim away, essentially.
So you have, an ocean, area of the ocean the size of New Jersey in which there are no swimming fish?
That's right. Dead zones are generally on the bottom of the ocean, so sometimes fish can live on the top.
Are they spreading? Are we seeing more of them?
Yeah, I think, many people are aware of the dead zone off Louisiana, but scientists have been tallying these around the globe, and now there are about 150 of these dead zones throughout the world. They seem to be doubling in size and number about every decade.
What's the effect on the kinds of marine life that flourish in this chemically altered ocean?
What scientists have really noticed is that marine mammals in particular are taking it on the chin. I noticed there were stories out of Florida just this week about manatees washing ashore dead from a red tide down there. And on this coast off California, every spring we get hundreds and sometimes thousands of sea lions and birds that wash ashore either dead or dazed and confused on the beaches. And they've basically been poisoned by a neurotoxin that is produced by an algae. And they pick up this neurotoxin by eating sardines or anchovies that consume the algae and pass it up the food chain. And this stuff's really insidious, and it attacks the memory centers of the brain. And the result is bizarre. Sea lions lose their way. They swim inland up rivers and drainage ditches and as far inland as Sacramento. And others tend to turn on their young. There was an amazing incident here last year when marine mammal workers came to a rehab center and found a sea lion pup shredded in its cage. And initially they thought vandals had come in, and only later realized that the mother had done this to her own young. The theory is that she had simply forgotten she had given birth, and when the pup tried to suckle, it ripped it apart.
And that's from a toxin they get from this algae that blooms in this nutrient-rich ocean.
That's right. This one is called Pseudonychia, and again, it seems to have a defense mechanism that can be very powerful, a neurotoxin that affects the hippocampus. It's basically the memory center of the brain.
Now, how does overfishing fit in? We've got nutrients dumping into the ocean, which tends to feed lots of microbial growth. What about the big fish, the tuna, the salmon, other big fish?
Yeah. Well, it turns out that an awful lot of the big fish have been taken from the oceans, and you've probably seen reports of 90% of the big fish are gone and predictions of collapses of seafood. But what basically happens, if you think about this as an energy cycle, we're stuffing the oceans with all this food, all this energy. And typically, algae would produce, then it would get eaten by smaller fish, that would get eaten by bigger fish and work their way up the food chain. Well, we've taken out a lot of the bigger fish. So what happens is that this energy, if you will, gets cycled into what scientists call a microbial loop. So you have a profusion of algae and bacteria, and it is not taken up the food chain, so it just stays in these sort of lower rungs.
And I think one scientist said we're working our way down the evolutionary ladder.
Yeah, I think the one concern is that sort of evolution in reverse. I mean, this is the way the seas used to look billions of years ago. It was all bacteria and then later algae. And then producing more advanced forms of life. These more advanced forms now are in retreat, and these other kinds of more primitive forms, they're very well adapted for change. And if they see a niche, they'll take it.
You write that jellyfish may be playing a more prominent role in the planet than in the past. Why?
Well, again, jellyfish have been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they seem to be very good at adapting and exploiting any kind of niche that opens up. So the sea turtles that eat jellies have been decimated. And there's lots and lots of things for jellyfish to eat, plankton, and basically algae. And so they've got lots of food and fewer predators, and they're moving in a big way.
And are they edible? Are we going to see more jellyfish dishes on menus 20 years from now?
Well, one of the fun things we did was we went out with a shrimper off of Georgia, and he's found he can make more money catching jellyfish than shrimp. And the reason is that shrimp have become quite scarce, and jellyfish have moved in a big way. And so one day we went out and caught tens of thousands of pounds of jellyfish, and those are processed right there in Darien, Georgia, and then shipped straight to China. And jellyfish salad and jellyfish soup is considered a delicacy in China and in Japan.
My guest is Ken Weiss. He is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Ken Weiss. He is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times and lead writer for a series on the altered chemical life of the oceans, which recently won the prestigious 2006 George Polk Award. You describe some waterfowl in the Midway Atoll, an island far from just about anywhere in the Pacific, which were dying because of plastic stuff in their stomachs. Where did it come from?
The issue of plastic marine debris is starting to become a hot topic. What makes plastic so useful for you and me, it's lightweight and durable and doesn't break down, makes it persist forever, virtually forever in the environment, particularly in the oceans. The plastic that we saw out in Midway was, most of it was from land-based sources, about four-fifths comes from the land. The other is jettisoned from boats. And the atolls out there act like basically giant combs in the middle of the Pacific and pick up this debris that's swirling around riding the currents. What we looked at out there were the albatross, and this is Midway Atoll where we were, which is about as far from any continent as you can get. I have to say, one of the most magical places I've ever been. It's exhilarating because there's so much life, about 2 million nesting seabirds. And it's also depressing because you see so much death. And what you see is you get to this island, and it's every square inch seems to be covered with some sort of Laysan albatross chick. And they're really sort of ridiculous in their appearance. They're about the size of a big chicken. And when we were there, they still have this downy fuzz over their face that made them look like they had a pompadour, like a bad Elvis impersonator. And you come up to them, and they start clacking their beaks as if to defend their turf. And they're quite adorable just when you see them like this, really sort of goofy birds. But then come back a few hours later, and their wings are drooped, and they're listless, and then the next day they're dead. And a wildlife biologist there, he showed us what was going on, and he would cut open the stomach of these birds, and in there would be 6 ounces or so of plastic, Lego toys, toothbrushes, toy soldiers, fishing lures, you name it. And the concern is that so much, they have so much plastic in their bellies that they're displacing the food and water they need to survive.
You write that some of the plastic takes the form of these little pellets called nurdles. What are they?
Yeah. Nurdles are essentially pre-production pellets. They're resin pellets. And these are fashioned out of petrochemicals, and they're the basic building block for all kinds of plastic materials. So these pellets are shipped from Houston and other petrochemical centers to industrial sites all over the country. And they flow like water, essentially, and then they're put into plastic molds and film extruders and this sort of thing, and make everything from plastic bags to medical devices to water bottles, you name it. What happens is some of these plastic pellets spill off of manufacturing lots, out of rail yards, and they basically get washed down streams and rivers out to sea. And again, they've been found all over the world. There's a scientist in Japan who's now studying their movement around the world. He likes them because these pellets soak up toxins like DDT and PCBs. And he has a program where people mail in these little pellets to him, and he can tell how much pollutants are in their area.
So they're sort of research vessels of a sort. Huh?
Yeah. They become little research sponges that circumnavigate the globe.
You know, in one of your more recent pieces, you look at what can be done to stop the flow of nutrients into the ocean, which is creating too much food for this microbial growth and altering the chemical balance there. What sort of technologies exist, or what methods exist for limiting all this extra food we're dumping into the ocean, and where are we seeing it implemented?
Well, there are a lot of technological fixes we can make to lessen the amount of nutrients we flush into the oceans. Our sewage systems, for the most part, are fairly antiquated. There's a lot of technology out there we could clean our wastewater to the level that we could drink it if we wanted to spend the money. That doesn't happen very often. Usually we still use pipes flowing out to the ocean as a way to jettison this stuff and hope it stays out of sight and out of mind.
I would have thought that most sewage in the United States is pretty treated, and that the days that in which raw sewage was dumped into the ocean were long gone. Are we talking about stormwater runoff that's polluted, or are we talking about sewage that is inadequately treated, or both?
Both, actually. If you look at sewage, it's true we have improved our sewage treatment. We've knocked down the harmful bacteria counts that could affect someone swimming in that water. But we do almost nothing to take out the nitrogen and the phosphorus, the food essentially that causes these algae blooms.
So the stuff that we would consider clean isn't good for the ocean.
That's right. It's still stoking the oceans with too much of a good thing, too much nitrogen, too much phosphorus, too much iron, all sorts of food that causes these blooms of algae.
So much attention has been paid to global warming, with Al Gore's movie and a lot of activism. What are the stakes here in terms of the chemical changes in the ocean? Are we talking about changes of diet and loss of recreation, or something far more serious?
Well, if you're talking about global warming, the oceans are the great equalizer for our climate. The oceans cover 71% of the planet, and they absorb basically half the CO2 that we're pumping into the atmosphere through tailpipes and smokestacks. There is a cost for the ocean absorbing all this CO2. It's actually causing a chemical change. They're becoming more acidic. And the question is, well, why would we care? And the problem is that every clam and oyster and coral animal relies on an alkaline ocean to pull out the building blocks, the calcium carbonates they use to build their shells. So what's going to happen and predicted by the end of the century is they simply become acidic enough that they won't have this basic material to build their homes. This hasn't happened yet. But in lab experiments, they've seen little snails essentially dissolve before their eyes, upping the level of CO2 that we're going to be seeing by the end of the century.
Are there practical things that ordinary folks can do that will make a difference?
Yeah, I think there are lots of things. And I think it's not necessarily having to give up a whole lot of things, but simply make wise choices. So, for instance, I love seafood and I love to eat fish, but I'm careful to eat fish that are in pretty good shape. Their populations are in good shape instead of those who are on the brink of joining an endangered species list. One interesting rule of thumb is to try to eat lower on the food chain. So oysters and clams and mussels and small fish like herring and sardines, they have an ability to reproduce very quickly and bounce back very quickly. That's very different than the top predators, such as sharks and swordfish and bluefin tuna, that take many years to become mature, and taking one of those out of the ocean has a much bigger impact than these fast-producing fish. I think a lot of people are aware of these campaigns to not to litter and not to wash your car and let the suds run down the street into the storm drain, not to dump oil into the storm drain, all these sorts of things. But I think ultimately there's only so much we can do as individuals. I think it's important that we participate, but ultimately it's going to be up to governments to make big changes.
Well, Ken Weiss, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Los Angeles Times writer Ken Weiss. His series with Usha Lee McFarling, Altered Oceans, has won the prestigious George Polk Award. You can find the link to the series on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you.
Support for NPR comes from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Gabriel Byrne talks with us about his life and work. His films include Miller's Crossing, The Usual Suspects, and the new movie Gendabine. And Ken Tucker reviews Traffic and Weather, the new album by Fountains of Wayne. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, actor Gabriel Byrne, has appeared in more than 50 feature films, often playing troubled or conflicted characters. He began acting in his 20s in Irish theater and television before moving to the United States at the age of 40. His films include Excalibur, Miller's Crossing, The Usual Suspects, The Man in the Iron Mask, and Vanity Fair. He stars in the new movie, Gendabine, which was featured at this year's Philadelphia Film Festival and opens later this month. Shot on location in Australia, the story revolves around four men who trek to a remote river for a fishing trip and discover the body of a murdered young woman. Rather than hiking out and reporting the discovery immediately, they complete their fishing trip before calling the police. That generates a community controversy and strains in their personal lives. In this scene, Burns' character Stuart is arguing with his wife, Claire, played by Laura Linney.
We have to move on. Look, I was worried that the girl would be dragged down to the rapids. Carl's ankle was f***ed. He couldn't walk. There was no way we could hike back. The kid was freaking out. There's nothing we could do. I don't see why I have to justify myself to you. Claire?
What if you'd found a boy in the river? Wouldn't you have taken him out and covered him up?
What? What are you talking about?
You don't know?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know where you're going with this. You're not making any sense.
Well, Gabriel Byrne, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
This new film, Jindabyne, it's the name of a town, which is a real place, a town in Australia that kind of has this interesting history, having been relocated to make room for a lake. You know, in some stories, the place itself is a character. I'm wondering, did this place bring anything unique to this story?
Well, the town of Jindabyne is, as you say, a relocated town. And the idea of an underground an underwater town or a buried town has kind of great kind of significance for me as an Irishman. I grew up listening to tales of towns buried underwater. In fact, one of the first stories I remember was hearing about the myth of Atlantis. Uh-huh. So to come to this town in New South Wales, where you could see on days of low tide, you could see the spires of the spire of the church and some of the roofs of the houses that had been vacated, was a mixture of awe and eeriness. So yes, it's a very major character in the film. The film takes place in the town, the new town of Jindabyne, and it concerns a murder that happens and the effect that the murder has on the inhabitants of this village.
Well, you know, a lot of people who've had the successful careers in acting that you have grew up in New York or Hollywood and were around show business. You weren't at all. I mean, you grew up in Ireland and you were the oldest of six kids, right?
Yes.
Stories of what you did in your 20s before you ever got into theater are pretty remarkable. You went to Spain and, did archaeology, taught school, is that right?
Yes, I graduated from university with a degree in languages and archaeology. So my first ambition was to become an archaeologist. And I don't think, really, I suppose what I ended up doing is that different, really. You know, rooting around, trying to find things, occasionally discovering something that, you know, makes you exuberant with delight. I then taught, I taught languages then in Dublin and in Spain, and I also had many other jobs that I was really not very competent at and got fired from most of them. But I like to think of myself before I went into acting as having the kind of career that if one was a paperback novelist, it would look good on the back and on the back cover.
When you did find your way into acting, you got onto a hit Irish TV series and
yes.
I gather became pretty well known pretty quickly. What drove you to acting in the first place? What got you there?
I often think that the last thing I should ever have been was an actor, really, because I don't like, to me, the notion of showing off in any way is appalling to me. I, I used to associate acting with kind of showing off. And when I was teaching, I taught extracurricular class in drama. And I began to see the effect that it had on the kids. And drama was able to reach them in a way that no conventional subject. I was teaching Gaelic and Spanish and English literature. Drama reached them in a way that none of those subjects did. And I realized that the reason for that was because they were actually not showing off, as I thought, but actually revealing who they were. And that it was a really complex and involved process. And yet I was still terrified to do it. And I was 27 before I decided to leave teaching for a year and become an actor, against all the advice of my fellow teachers and my family and friends, who all told me I was crazy to do it. And I said, I'll give it a year and see how it goes. And in that time, I was lucky enough to join the Project Theatre, which was just coming into existence in Dublin at that time. And it was just one of those rare, confluences of luck and timing and everything. Jim Sheridan, Neil Jordan, Stephen Ray, Liam Neeson, Colm Meaney, Ciarán Hinds, myself, we were all in this garage basically working for $25 a week in repertory company, putting on different plays that we'd written ourselves or that, you know, that we, some of the great classics. And so I learned to be part of an ensemble there, and I discovered the addiction of theatre, the addiction of performing, which really had more to do, again, with expressing the inexpressible about oneself.
And the addiction was not to the attention, not to the spotlight. It was to expressing something meaningful.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And the joy of the effect that the drama had on the audience. And I grew up in that kind of an environment. But I grew up listening to great storytellers when I was a child. There was an old man who used to come to my aunt's house, and he would come into the kitchen, and he had a chair by the fire, and almost the entire village would turn out to see this man who performed in different houses around once, twice a year. And he would begin in total silence by saying something like, "This didn't happen to me, and it didn't happen to my father, and it didn't happen to my father's father. But it did happen to my father's father's father." So what he was saying was, I don't want to stand over any of the details of this, but I am telling you that it's true, but it's far enough in the past to be rendered unexaminable. And so I watched the effect that a man like that had on people listening and how they were moved and affected by it. And I got that same sense in the theater.
Well, it's interesting. If the addiction of acting was the effect of telling a gripping story and revealing something about oneself and seeing what that did for an audience, it's interesting that you've done so many movies where day after day you go from a trailer to a set and there really is no audience other than, you know, the crew and the other and your fellow actors.
Well, there's the camera, and somebody told me once, Alan Bates, actually the English actor, years ago told me, he said, you know, the amazing thing about the camera is that the camera photographs thought. And I never forgot that, because if you look into the lens of a camera, the first thing I do, usually because I'm extremely nervous on the first couple of days of any film, is I go up to the camera and I stare it down. I look into the depths of it and I stare it down, try to stare down its power. And I think of all the people who are inside in the camera, who are sitting in there listening and watching, and I try to not be afraid of them.
My guest is Gabriel Byrne. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining me, my guest is actor Gabriel Byrne. His new film is Gendibine. Well, I wanted to talk about Miller's Crossing, which you did in 1990, the Coen Brothers film, which was, I guess, a breakout role for you in a way. There you play Tom Reagan, who's a trusted associate of a mob kingpin, I guess, in the 20s or 30s. And I thought we'd play a clip here. This is where your boss, Leo, who's played by Albert Finney, has come to you in the middle of the night because he's concerned he can't find the lady he's seeing. Her name is Verna. And your character, Tom, is a very perceptive guy who sees things about Verna that Leo doesn't. So here we are. Let's listen.
Tommy, I don't know where Verna is.
Uh-huh.
I know what you're thinking. What else is new? But the situation now, I'm worried.
Verna can take care of herself. Maybe better than you can.
What does that mean?
Want another one?
No. What does that mean?
How far she got her hooks into you?
That's a hell of a question.
It's a grift. If she didn't need you to protect her brother from Johnny Casper, you think she'd still be going on slow carriage rides with you through the park? That's the deal, isn't it? You keep Bernie under wraps till Casper cools down?
Jesus, you're a prickly pear. What's wrong with him wanting a brother taken care of?
Nothing. I don't blame her. She sees the angle, which is you. She plays it. She's a grifter. Just like her brother. Probably had grifter parents and grifter grandparents, and someday they're each going to spawn little grifter kids.
Stop it, Tommy. I don't like to hear my friends run down even by other friends.
Friendship's got nothing to do with it.
Hell, you say you do anything to help your friends like you do anything to kick your enemies.
Wrong, Leo. You do things for a reason.
Okay, Tom. You know all the angles. Christ, better than anybody. But maybe you're wrong about this. You don't know what's in Verna's heart.
Leo, if she's such an angel, why are you looking for her at 4 o'clock in the morning?
And that's Gabriel Byrne and Albert Finney from the film Miller's Crossing. A great piece of dialogue there. You want to tell us a little about getting this role, this Coen Brothers role?
Well, when I came to America for the first time, I was 40 years old when I did that picture, and it was the first picture I did in America. But I think that it came out at the same time as Goodfellas, so it got overlooked as a gangster film. But the language of it and the visual imagery of the film, the humor and the extremely complex plot and relationships between the characters, it's a film that has lived on, strangely enough. So many people have seen it on DVD, and the more famous the Coen brothers got, of course, the more people wanted to go back and look at their previous work, and they came across this kind of this hidden kind of picture. I think that when it came out the first weekend, it made about $4,000 or something.
And really?
It was just, yeah, I remember sitting in the cinema in at Carnegie Hall, and there was two people in this gigantic cinema, and myself and two friends of mine, and the guy in front of me who was with his wife kept saying to his wife, "What are they saying? I can't hear. Who is this guy?" And I wanted to just tap him on the shoulder and say, "Hold on, it gets, you know, it all gets explained at the end."
Now, it was around then that you moved to L.A., right?
Was yes.
After you made the film, right? And I mean, I know that Ireland is such an important part of your background. I mean, that you studied Irish literature and speak Irish. Mm. And I'm wondering, was when you relocated to L.A., was it difficult? Was it culturally jarring?
Yes, it was. I think that even for people who don't come from somewhere like Ireland, I think L.A. can be culturally very confusing. A friend of mine who was a designer said to me one day, he said, "I come up your road and it's Beverly Hills 2001. And he says, "I come into your house and it's Connemara 1943. So I don't know what that says about LA or my house, but I tried to keep my sense of identity and my sense of who I am in LA. And I remember once driving my car out the driveway, and there was a group of men walking down the street, and I thought, wow, that's very unusual to see a group of men walking together on that street. Because people don't walk in Beverly Hills, really, except maybe they walk their dogs or something. But, and as they came closer, I realized that I recognized one of the men. And they would, the group would stop outside each house, and they would point in and then explain something and then move on to the next house. So I thought, this is weird. I'm going to wait just to see how... And it was Ronald Reagan, and he was in the very last days of his... of his illness, and because it was a flat part of Beverly Hills, they used to walk him there. And I remember he crossed the road, and they all went behind him. And there was a group of Mexican men who had just finished working on a garden there. And what's really unusual is that nobody talks to Mexican gardeners in LA. So here was this man talking to this group of Mexicans who couldn't believe that the ex-president of the United States was talking to them. And I just remember, I don't know why that incident stands out in my mind, but the idea, I suppose, that so little happened on that street that was unusual, that the idea of four men in the distance walking together was enough to make me stop my car and say, this is weird.
I wanted to talk a little bit about... The Usual Suspects, which was a film you did in 1992, which is just a real kind of cult favorite. Did you know this was going to be such a great film as you were making it?
No, not at all. In fact, you can never predict anything. I mean, we laughed for 25 days. We shot that picture in 25 days, and we laughed all the way through it. And in fact, they left things in the movie that were actually... another director would have taken out, but Bryan Singer brilliantly left in takes where we were just cracking up because it showed the camaraderie between these five people.
Now that's funny. You know, I don't think of that movie as filled with laughs. I mean, can you recall a take that one of the spontaneous takes that made it in the film?
When in the lineup, when they all get to say, "Give me the keys." None of us could stay in character because we all thought what the other was doing was so funny. And if you look at the moment, Stephen Baldwin is completely, like, mental. And then Kevin Pollak has his version of it, which is totally the opposite and very, very funny. And then Benicio del Toro... who did a brilliant, took a brilliant decision to be not understood by the audience. So all that stuff was improvised. So it was very difficult to not laugh. So there's a shot of us all laughing at each other that's left in the film. And I think it's just, it's an inspired piece of spontaneity, and it really works for the picture.
Well, Gabriel Byrne, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Dave, thank you so much indeed. It was a pleasure.
Actor Gabriel Byrne. His new film is Gendabine. Here's that scene from The Usual Suspects we were just talking about. We'll hear Kevin Pollak, Stephen Baldwin, Benicio del Toro, a little narration from Kevin Spacey, and then Gabriel Byrne.
Number one, step forward.
Hand me the keys, you
Number two, step forward.
Jeez,
you
knock it off. Get back. Number three, step forward.
How many keys?
In English, please.
Excuse me.
In English.
How many? I go, what the?
Number four, step forward.
It was bull. The whole rap was a setup.
Hand me the keys, you
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Fountains of Wayne, their first collection of new songs in 4 years. This is Fresh Air. Fountains of Wayne, the band led by songwriters Adam Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood, has a new album called Traffic and Weather, their first collection of new songs in 4 years. The band came close to becoming a mass audience act in 2003 with a hit single and music video for their song Stacy's Mom. More recently, Schlesinger wrote some of the parody pop songs for the Drew Barrymore-Hugh Grant movie, Music and Lyrics. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the new album is a deeper exploration of the central question about Fountains of Wayne. Are they making potential hit songs or satirizing them?
Seth Shapiro got his law degree. He moved to Brooklyn from Schenectady, 93. Got some clients in the food industry. He says it's not the money, it's the recipes. He calls his mom, says he's doing fine. She's got somebody on the other line. Puts Coldplay on, pours a glass of wine. He curls up with a book about organized crime.
That's Someone to Love, the song that leads off Fountains of Wayne's Traffic and Weather. It's the album's first single and typically first-rate craft. This is a tale of two lonely urban singletons told with tight little rhymes that get the details both right, consuming Coldplay with white wine, and depressingly specific. While the song's lyric may be too downbeat for mass amusement, the melody is a chipper counterpoint. And anyway, the video for this song is going to star Dimitri Martin, a young comic with a lot of hip cred for his genuinely funny work on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. But Fountains of Wayne aren't, to their credit, going for facile coolness. Consider this finely observed, almost majestic anecdote of betrayal.
I saw you holding hands with some guy wearing light blue Dockers pants, and I thought that I might just give you a chance to explain what the hell is in your brain. You know you pretend you're going to see bright for the long weekend, but something don't seem right, and your best friend Renee keeps on saying she saw you at the Gap with somebody in a baseball cap.
Fountains of Wayne music always aspires to a platonic ideal. Teen pop music that sounds as smooth and catchy as anything recorded by Gary Lewis and the Playboys in the 60s or Hilary Duff in the present time. But whereas those acts were and are able to sing in the first person about fresh heartache and youthful self-doubt, as 30 going on 40-somethings, Schlesinger and Collingwood know that they would sound like fakes or knaves if they tried to do that. And so, like Chuck Berry so many years before them, they create younger, less jaded characters than themselves who carry the emotions the band wants to get across. Chuck had Nadine and Little Queenie. Fountains of Wayne have Michael and Heather at the baggage claim.
Michael and Heather at the baggage claim. Tired of playing the waiting game. Every bag has got a different name. Michael and Heather may never get home again. Michael and Heather.
Schlesinger and Collingwood put word power into their pop, composing taut couplets with frequent interior rhymes. In various songs here, their way of keeping it real is to name-check Costco, Light Blue Dockers, and the sitcom The King of Queens. They inhabit our world as much as a band can, whose co-leader scores Hollywood movies and is writing the score for a John Waters Broadway musical. In that same tradition, Fountains of Wayne do it the old-fashioned songwriting way, putting their anxieties, their insecurities, and their ambivalence into their puns, their rhymes, and their melodies. Whereas most pop rock strives to sound tossed off, Fountains of Wayne aren't afraid to let their naked ambition stand revealed.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Traffic and Weather by Fountains of Wayne. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillug, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with writer Kurt Vonnegut, the author of Slaughterhouse-Five and Cat's Cradle. He died Wednesday at the age of 84. Join us for the next Fresh Air.